break. So yeah, we're going to be having a look at The Taste of Freedom. This is a talk that Bhante gave, Sangha actually gave in 1980 in London, in the Caxton Hall. And so the SWBO was in full swing. It had been going for 13 years by then. And there was the Buddhist Centre here was up and running. Retreat centres were up and running. So people were practicing Buddhism. It was the first time he'd given a talk for a little while. I think he said it was about a year after he'd given the last talk. And so he'd come to London to give a talk. And he started off with a question. He started off with the question, and that question was, what is Buddhism? What is Buddhism? And he's saying it's often described in many different ways. So some people see it as a code of ethics, a system of ethics. Maybe some people think of it as an Eastern philosophy or even Eastern mysticism. It's seen as a spiritual path. And some people think of it as a tradition. And he says it's even been described as a religion. So just to say it's worth... you know, we were saying before about Bhante's talks being put down into books and read. They're really worth reading. But if you get the chance, listen to his talks as well. If you go onto freebuddhistaudio.com, you can hear many, many of his talks. And you hear firsthand. And often the written transcriptions in the books, you miss a little bit. You often miss his humour. So he's got quite a gentle humour. And sometimes... you read something and you're thinking, oh, that's meant completely seriously. And then sometimes there's just a little bit of humour there as well. So it's always worth listening to it. And then he said, worse still, for the last 100-odd years, it's been described as Buddhism. So, but he was saying it wasn't known as Buddhism until then. It was known as the Dharma, the truth, what the Buddha taught. Or even the Dharma Vinaya, so the principle and practice of what the Buddha taught. But Bhante goes on to say that maybe the best way of describing what we call Buddhism is through an image. And this is an image that the Buddha gave, and it was one of the great ocean. So it's not, you know, it's an image rather than a concept, rather than an abstract idea. And he gave it in the Udana, which is a collection of his sayings. And accordingly, in the Udana, he gave these, the Buddha gave these spontaneously, gave these teachings spontaneously. And so Bhante goes on to describe how the Buddha was sitting in the forest in a full moon night, and sitting in a grove. So in the days of the Buddha and his followers, the ones who had gone forth, would wander the paths. They'd beg for alms from the villagers, but then they'd sit under a tree and meditate, and they'd meet every now and then in groups, especially on the full moon night, and they'd meet to practice together, to meditate together. And so he's describing one of these times. So very, very still. The stories, if you read the Pali Canon, there's stories of the Buddha and his disciples, and it's very, very, you know, describing this beautiful scene where it's a very, very still. No one's fidgeting. Everyone's sitting completely still. As Bhante says, no one even blows their nose. So, it's just this this like lovely silence that people are sitting in. He's saying it's maybe not even meditation. Maybe when you've got to that stage, you're just sitting with each other. And he talks about the bhikkhus, and the bhikkhus are often described as monks. But Bhante prefers, at least for this lecture, he prefers to talk about them as partakers, which is an interesting word. But they're partakers of the food of the land. So they go every day, there's an alms round. It's part of the monk or the nun, part of their daily routine. And this begging for alms is seen as quite a noble thing to do in India. They take as much as they need just to keep going. And then they also partake and share what the Buddha taught as well, the Dharma Vinaya. So it's so they're partaking together. They're sharing the spiritual life. So he talked about, the Buddha talked about the great ocean. He gave the image of the great ocean. And he talked about eight strange and wonderful things about the great ocean. I'm not going to go into all of them. Amongst those eight, he talked about the taste of freedom. So, but before that, he talked about other aspects of the great ocean. And you've got to remember that the Buddha lived in, well, a largely landlocked place. He lived in a great continent. And he, accordingly, we, as far as we know, he never saw the ocean. He never saw the sea. He'd only heard rumours of it. He'd only heard rumours of this great ocean. And there was, they knew the Ganges, this grand river, something like the Thames. They'd never seen the great ocean. Maybe some of his disciples had travelled that far. But, he spent most of his life in the size, walking around in something of the size of whales. That sort of, if you can imagine, northern India as whales. Wandering footpaths of northern India. So they'd not heard of the ocean. The ocean was almost like a mythical thing that, occasionally they'd hear about. They'd heard it was like vast, endless. No one knew what the other end of the ocean was like. They'd heard it was filled with great mythical creatures. Particularly in those days, there was all sorts of belief in all sorts of creatures. Maybe, as Bhante said, the marine biology wasn't quite what we know now. But, there's all sorts of mythical creatures in the depths. He talks about how the rivers go into the ocean, and when they enter the ocean, they leave behind their names. The Ganges leaves behind its name. It's no longer the Ganges once it enters the great ocean. And it leaves behind its lineage, the way that rivers flow along and are, have their lineage, as it were, probably high in the mountains. The rivers come along and then end up in the great ocean. And he's making the simile, he's making the comparison to the Dharma Vinaya. He's saying that when spiritual practitioners, bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, go forth, go into the spiritual life, they leave behind their former names and their former lineages. For instance, in our order, we leave behind our previous names that we've been given. But also, we leave maybe something, some of our previous conditioning. In the Buddha's time, he particularly talked about the caste system. So there was the early caste system at the time. Whether you were a warrior or a serf or a nobleman, and you left that all behind when you went forth into the spiritual life. And Bhante talks about, in the way for us, maybe it's leaving behind our nationality. How much do we think of ourselves as English, Welsh, Scottish, Irish, French, German, etc., when we start to practice the spiritual life? as it were, we leave that behind. That's not the primary thing for us. The Dharma Vinaya is the primary thing. One's simply a committed human being relating to others, other committed human beings. So, yeah, the talk that this is based on, it talks about one taste. The ocean has one taste, the taste of salt. And similarly, the Dharma Vinaya has one taste, and that's the taste of release, the taste of emancipation, and the taste of freedom. So Buddhism, the Dharma, Dharma Vinaya has the taste of freedom. So he says, what is freedom? What is freedom? I don't know if it's something that that you think about. Is it something current? It seemed to be very much in the air when Bhante gave these lectures, you know, and especially in the 60s and the 70s. There was a lot spoken about freedom, and there was a lot acted upon. You know, there was a civil rights movement and achieving psychological freedom as well. So you've talked about freedom. It's called vimutti in Pali, or vimukti in Sanskrit. And yeah, he describes it as release, emancipation, or freedom. And he's saying, well, although, you know, civil and political liberties are obviously very good in themselves, you know, vimutti isn't to be equated with that. Freedom is just a word we've used to translate vimutti. It's kind of the provisional, it's provisionally equivalent. So what is vimutti, he asks. And but he sort of stops there and says, before he goes into that, he talked about something else. So before I go further, I'm just wondering if there's anything that any thoughts or reflections so far. Yeah, let's continue. So he talks about the way the great ocean is, he talks about the strange and wonderful things, eight strange and wonderful things about the great ocean, eight strange and wonderful things. And he says we might have missed a couple of words in there. One is strange and one is wonderful. And he says he wants to give them their full force. So he really wants to sort of look at what these words are. And I think one of the things Bhante is particularly good at is really looking at the Buddhist texts and giving words their full force and really seeing the significance of certain words, certain phrases, and bringing out the significance for us. So he's saying, well, as I said before, in the valley of the Ganges, where the Buddha and his disciples were, is many miles, hundreds of miles from the ocean. So it's, you know, this was a great rumour that this great body of water. And it was like the ocean's foreign, it's a foreign element, unfamiliar. And it's actually strange to us. So in the same way that the ocean's strange, the Dharma is strange to us. Buddhism is strange to us. The spiritual life is strange to us. Enlightenment is strange to us. It's like we've only really heard about the Buddha. The Buddha is strange to us. Even describes the Buddha as the stranger who's standing on our doorstep. But do we really recognise him? So what do you think about that? Why do you think Buddhism is strange? Why do you think the Dharma is strange to us?
Very often.
Yeah.
Very often it's counterintuitive.
It's counterintuitive, yeah. Yeah. Do you want to say a little bit more? Yeah.
Well, I think it relates a bit to what Niala Bach was saying. You know, we think most of the time we've been educated and brought up that the toast at midnight or going to see Mission Impossible or falling in love with somebody is going to satisfy. And actually it doesn't. And what I found bit by bit is that if I can allow that wanting to grasp those things that I think are going to satisfy, if I let that grasping habits go and not relate to it, something much more, much richer comes into me.
So something kind of, as it were, other, something that we didn't expect maybe comes into our lives, and there's actually a lot more satisfying, a lot more fulfilling than the things that we think would be.
Yeah.
Like a foreign land. Thank you. So did you want to say something? Oh, great. Any other thoughts about strangeness, strangers?
I suppose something strange, if it's, if it's unrecognizable, the grasp is something that we know.
Yes, yes.
And we recognize things, I suppose, by using our conceptual minds. Perhaps the strangeness is pointing to the possibility of another way of experiencing. Experiencing which isn't in terms of anything you already know.
Yes.
A direct way of
experiencing. Yeah, I think that's good, isn't it? It's sort of, quite often we think we know things, we've thought it, you know, we think it, we've got an idea of what things are. But do we really know? Do we really know? And I like the way you said maybe there's another way of experiencing things, a more direct way. The way we, you know, when we meditate, do we might have a direct, non-conceptual experience of the truth. And that in some ways is strange to us because maybe we haven't experienced that, or maybe we've had a glimpse of it, a glimpse of a glimpse. And it's just a new way of being, a new way of operating. And I guess what Vante is saying is just being open to that possibility, not having an idea about Buddhism, you know. And I guess it's very difficult not to have that, but having an idea about Buddhism and Buddhism's going to calm me down, or you know, sort of help me relax. But actually, if you really take on the Dharma, you really take on the Dharma Vinaya, Buddhism, it will do something a lot more. It'll be a lot more fulfilling, and a lot more, you'll feel a lot more alive. But there's not, it's not what we think it's going to be somehow. It's a lot more. It is freedom.
It's also strange, it's so much less short term sort of satisfaction.
Right, yeah.
Comparing to like the toast example. You only start realizing, you can only sort of through practice, and that's very much against what we sort of just clinging on to being there. Like a sort of instant reward.
Yes. Yeah, it's true, isn't it? Sort of, we tend to go for the bars of chocolate, the toast, or whatever it is, and you know, sometimes the bit delayed, you know, delayed gratification is better, as you know, trying to, you know, work on something, working on our meditation, can yield greater results, as it were, greater satisfaction. Yeah. Okay, so he continues to talk about this. So he's talking about strangeness, and so the other word he wants to focus on is wonderful. So how is the great ocean wonderful? And he describes the great ocean. You know, it's vast. It's very beautiful. There's all sorts of shades of colours. It's in perpetual movement. There's the sounds of the ocean. It's like a great symphony, crashing away or very, very quiet. And there's unfathomable depths. And we might, you know, maybe one day we might swim in the great ocean for the very first time. Maybe we're very fortunate in this country. We're surrounded by sea, but a lot of the world, you know, you don't get to see the ocean. And he was saying it's the same with the Dharma Vinaya, but in this way, it is an infinite ocean. It's a shoreless ocean. And it's continually speaking to us, singing to us, playing its own inimitable music. It's fascinating. There's brilliant and tender lights and colours. And it's so deep we can never really hope to fathom. Never really hope to fathom it. And he's saying the Dharma Vinaya is wonderful. Buddhism is wonderful. Spiritual community is wonderful. And we might like to think, you know, meditation is wonderful. Studying Buddhism is wonderful. Spiritual friendship is wonderful. Devotional practice is wonderful. So any thoughts about that? Is Buddhism wonderful? So maybe we can, maybe in a certain way, it's like a great feast or something where, you know, we come along and there's so much, some people want to try out meditation and, you know, get something from that. Some people, want to...
And spiritual Buddhism, or some people like just mindfulness, or...
Mm. Mm, yeah, devotional, or maybe meditational, or maybe people like reading about it. Yeah, there's many different ways into the Buddhism. Into Buddhism. Yeah. Any other thoughts about wonder? Wonderful. The Dharma Vinaya is wonderful.
Seems to me that most personal development does stem from Buddhism.
Right. It's affecting Western culture, isn't it? It's affecting lots of, you know, Western psychology, etc., isn't it? Yeah.
Whether or not the practitioners know it fully, but it does seem just like that.
Sort of over the last 100 or so years, you know, the Dharma Vinaya is beginning to meet Western culture, and there's, you know, interesting to notice what's actually happening. Anything else is wonderful. Why do you think he's sort of stressing the point here? Why is wonder wonderful? Why is he pointing this out?
Is this a sense of curiosity?
Oh, yeah. That's
really non-judgment. Gentleness.
The curiosity about your experience, sort of beginning to learn about one's experience in meditation, learning about other people, learning about the truth of the Dharma. And that's wonderful, isn't it? Learning something new.
I like the aspect of wonder, which is that sense of awe.
Ah, yeah.
And that sense of being sort of struck anew.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And could you say maybe what has struck you with awe or wonder? What's...
Well, going on retreat for the first time and sort of coming out of the meditation and just that sense of that immediacy of experience and just Just inhabiting my own body. Just noticing physical things. I remember a bird in a tree and just having this strong sense of all they needed was a nest. That's all they needed.
Yeah.
And here am I with like a very complex array of stuff.
Yes. Sort of really coming back to ourselves, back to our senses, isn't it? Sometimes in our busy lives, we're in our heads and we just don't notice our senses. We're not mindful of the sounds we can hear, the sounds of the birds. I was in the countryside over the weekend and I suddenly noticed, there's all this bird song early in the morning, all this bird song. It's just beautiful, it's wonderful. And just noticing nature is wonderful, isn't it? Just, in fact, noticing is wonderful, because so much of our time we're sort of bound up in our own thoughts and our own obsessions and our own plans and anxieties, and just noticing what's going on around us can be very, very wonderful. And like you say, on retreat, it's an ideal time to experience that, because it's a lot more simple life, and we can just experience the beauty around us, and we can get to experience that sense of awe and wonder. And I think that's why it is so important to have awe and wonder in our lives, and to sort of cultivate that and to find that wherever we have that. Maybe it's recently I've been looking at the reading about and watching science programs to do with astronomy and to do with the planets and to do with the solar system, and just really, really enjoying that and having a sense of awe at the perspective of I'm just in my head a lot of the time, here in my body maybe some of the time, but actually there's this great Earth, but we're part of this vast solar system that's come into being, and life has appeared on that, which is incredible, really. It's just remarkable. And so much of our time, I think, we tend to sort of narrow down to the day-to-day, to the mundane. And if we can open up, it's just very, very valuable, very, very important in a way to be able to have some sense of awe and wonder in our lives. He says, Plato, according to Plato, philosophy begins with a sense of wonder. And according to Bante, no spiritual life without an ever-continuing sense of wonder. So it's really, really important. So he's saying the partakers, the followers of the Buddha, see the strange and wonderful qualities again and again and again. So it's not something we just have just initially, and then it wears off and everything's old hat. It's like seeing a favourite film again and again. And in fact, the more the partakers see and hear of the Dharma Vinaya, the more wonderful it appears. So this grows, this sense of awe and wonder grows. And you take delight in the Dharma Vinaya. So no, it's not just wonderful and strange, it's also enjoyable. So spiritual life is enjoyable. Meditation is enjoyable. Coming to classes is enjoyable, I hope. making spiritual friends is enjoyable, and so on. And he even goes on to say, having our faults pointed out is enjoyable. Being thrown in at the deep end is enjoyable. And not being allowed to rationalise is enjoyable. So, and then this is, again, just this bit of gentle humour as well that he brings in. He's deadly serious, but just this bit of gentle humour. So it's just what he says. It's really, really important to remember that Buddhism, the Dharma Vinaya, is enjoyable. It's and he's saying how much this differs from the usual concept that we might have grown up with about religion. I'm not sure if it still exists, but definitely maybe a few years ago, this idea that you had to put on your Sunday face or whatever, you know, sort of had to be very, very serious when you went to church. So Bhante gets back to vimutti, back to emancipation, back to freedom. And he says, but what is vimutti? What is this? What is vimutti? And so he says it has to be looked at in the complete scheme of spiritual development. And he looks now at what's called the positive nidanas. Now we're going to have to have a look at this really, really quickly, I think, because I do want to move on to other things. But I did write down the positive nidanas. And this is a description of where we are now. And as you can imagine, a spiral here. Can't draw spirals very easily, Frank. Until enlightenment. And it starts off with dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness, or suffering, leading to faith and devotion. And faith is shraddha, which is not blind faith, but it's confidence in the path, leading through satisfaction and delight, rapture, tranquility and bliss, samadhi, and then knowledge and vision of things as they really are, leading all the way through to vimutti, and then knowledge of the description of the biases. And this is equivalent to enlightenment. So he's saying vimutti is actually a very, very placed very, very highly. So vimutti isn't what we normally think of as freedom. It's just translated as that. It's something very, very much very high in the scheme of things, in the spiritual path. So this is our development, this is our personal development, our development of consciousness. You know, we're starting from the bottom, as it were, and working our way up. And what he was saying is that vimutti, an important thing to notice is vimutti, freedom, comes after knowledge and vision of things as they really are. So it's beyond freedom in the ordinary psychological sense or the political sense. And then he looks at these links, rapture, tranquility, bliss and samadhi. And he's saying this describes the meditation. And this is sort of ever more refined states of mind, where things, we get more and more integrated, more and more positive emotion flows. And samadhi is a very, very high level of consciousness, a refined level of consciousness. But then he says, moving from samadhi to knowledge and vision of things as they really are is a really important step. In fact, he's saying it's the crucial step. This first stage up to samadhi is described as samatha, shamatha. It's calm with a capital C. It's what we're doing in the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana. We're cultivating awareness, we're cultivating positive emotion. And a very, very important thing, it's becoming a happy, healthy human being. That's the first goal of Buddhism, a happy, healthy human being. Very important. But knowledge and vision of things as they really are is equivalent to what's called insight or vipassana. And at this point, we're no longer... we begin to have a taste of something other. We're having a taste of what we were talking about before, this strangeness, this something other. Knowledge and vision of things as they really are. It's described as entering the stream. So entering the stream that leads all the way to the ocean and becoming what's called a stream entrant. So he says, to do this, to move from samatha to vipassana, we need to break three fetters. And elsewhere he's described these three fetters, and these three fetters are things that bind us to the mundane world, to our ordinary consciousness. But he describes these three fetters in a sort of very down-to-earth ways. And I just want to spend a bit of time looking at these three fetters. So these are, he's describing as the fetter of habit, the fetter of superficiality, and the fetter of vagueness. Okay. And so first of all, the fetter of habit. And he's saying habit is a sort of tendency to act in a particular way. So it's to do with action. So accordingly to the Dharma, we are our actions. A person is the sum total of our actions. There's nothing beyond that. That's, as it were, all there is. Actions of body, speech and mind. The person, we don't exist apart from our actions. And he was saying, well, we are our habits. And then he says, we are ourselves simply a habit. And the person we think we are, John or Mary, is simply a habit, a stream of consciousness that's got into a certain way of being, like a knot tied in a string. And he's saying, since we've got ourselves into this, we can get ourselves out of that. We can untie the knot. So, breaking the fetter of habit is getting out of the habit of being the sort of person we are. So it's only a habit that we've got into. So he's saying, you don't have to be the way you are. And another way of looking at it is getting rid of the old self and becoming something new, someone new, a true individual. Someone who's aware, emotionally positive and responsible, sensitive and creative. So often talk about non-self in Buddhism, anatta. But Bhante looks at it another way. He says, it's not so much never having a self, but we always have a new self. And the idea that we're always trying to have a better self than the one previously. And that's what we mean by progress. So he's saying it's not easy to get out of the habit of being oneself, of our actions, our habits. And part of that is the fact that there is the fact of other people as well. So if other people, not only are we used to being a certain way, being in a habit, but other people are used to us being in a certain way as well. So it's just recognising that, because often what he calls the group is less like to let us sort of progress. So it's noticing that. So we can break the fetter of habit. So any thoughts about this, the fetter of habit? Anything strike you?
Just being bored by the sound of my own voice.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
It's just, again and again, coming up against the same old stuff.
Ah, right, yeah,
So, yes, that's boring and habitual.
Right, yeah.
But also, having sort of, you know, on and off meditated for a while, just noticing how I have a tendency to sort of anxiety or irritability. And it's almost like I really want to be irritated.
Ah, okay, yes.
And then if I can catch it, that's one, but because I'm irritable with certain sorts of people.
Yes, yes.
But that tendency is incredibly strong.
Yes, 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 yes. It's a strong habit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting what you're saying. I thought it was really good when you say you're bored of it. You know, you sort of see again and again these habits. And I think we can do that, can't we? We can begin to, once we begin to notice when we meditate, we begin to notice our minds, our hearts. It's sort of the same old thing, isn't it? Going, oh dear, I'm doing that again. I wish I wouldn't, I wish I didn't have to do that. I wish I didn't lose my temper all the time, or I wish I didn't have to get into anxiety. And like you're saying, these are very strong habits as well. As Bhante said, it's not easy to break out of these habits. These can run very deep, very, very deep.
And weirdly, be comfortable.
Ah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's almost easier to be annoyed than it is to go
a bit. Yes, yeah.
It's kind of tantalising.
Yeah. Sort of, sort of almost pleasurable to be in those states, even though it's not really pleasure, it's not really truly satisfying. I think it was a Zen story about at the marketplace. I think it was the fish seller that the woman who sold the fish missed sort of her transport home, and but the flower seller said, well, you can stay at mine, I've got space in the flower shop, you can stay there, you can sleep overnight. And the fish seller was very glad of this and lay down, but tossed and turned, just couldn't sleep. And then realised what it was, and it was the scent of the flowers. And then when she realised what it was, grabbed her old fish bucket and just put it over her head. And with that beautiful smell of half-rotten fish, she fell asleep into a deep sleep. And it's like what we're used to, it's the states of mind that we're used to. It's like we don't really want to, as you were saying, move out of those... states of mind, those sort of things, even though there's something better if we just allowed ourselves. There's a better way of being, there's better habits. What could be? Yeah. Thank you.
But how do you know there's something better? I think that's what I find. It's not, I recognise that it's pleasurable, but I think there's something deeper that I think, well, who will I be? You know, there's a very strong sense of this is what defines me, my irritability, anxiety. For me, it's more irritability. I'm not convinced enough that there is something. I'm not even better that there is anything else. You know, I think if I was convinced of that, I'd let go more easily. I'm probably a little bit convinced, but I think it's. It's that sense of identity that I get from, in my case, irritability. I was talking to a friend the other day, she said the very same thing about anxiety. She felt the pain of it, but she couldn't quite make the leap.
No. You've identified, it's been you for so long, hasn't it? That, whether it's irritability, anxiety, or whatever, it's been you for so long, it's been me for so long.
Yeah.
That where would you be without it, almost?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, who would you be without?
Who would you be? And I'd probably beg to differ, Subhadramati. I think, you know, you probably have, else you wouldn't be, you know, doing the things you're doing. So, But also take what you say, you know, if you could really see it.
Yeah.
If we could really see it, we could just let go.
Yeah.
Let go of that way of being. Yeah. And I guess it's the difference between the known and the unknown, isn't it? The unknown, the strangeness.
Yeah.
And if we can just sort of begin to let go, trust that there is something better, that we're not just sort of letting go into a black hole, but that actually we're letting go into the great ocean, maybe something very warm, very welcoming, if only we knew it, very satisfying, very fulfilling, very beautiful. But it's maybe it's this bit here at the bottom. It's faith and devotion. It's Shraddha. It's confidence. The more that we have the confidence that there is something that we can let go into, the more we're more likely to take that step. And that can take a while to, can take a lifetime to develop, can't it?
It also takes a lot of courage.
Yeah, yeah.
Scary.
Yes, yes it is, isn't it? It's scary. Fear plays a lot. Do you want to say a bit more?
Stop playing the usual thing, being Polish, German, hearing about where everybody is getting.
Yeah.
So when I just go somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like I might, although I feel a bit closer to people.
Yes, yes.
But I feel like they might see me a bit
strange. Strange, yes. Yes, and that's scary as well, isn't it?
Changing the habits or breaking the habits.
Yeah. Exactly. If it's deciding, well, I'm not going to drink now, you know, I mean, that's really, for some people, it's like they can feel that as really like you're pushing them away, or if I decided to, you know, become a vegetarian, or I'm going to meditate. It can be threatening to some people. And like you're saying, it can feel like, oh, well, I'm being a bit odd here, I'm a bit strange, even though it's actually something a lot more satisfying for yourself. And I like what you said about you can actually feel more connected. Because often what we're doing is just being in the group, being with others, just doing what's expected, buying the next round or, you know, doing what, you know, following the career path, just because, well, that's what's expected. Yeah.
They mirror back to you the story you're telling about yourself, which is quite disempowering. So, for example, my niece is going through a shy stage because when you meet her, even people that she knows, she's going to, she sort of won't want to recognise you.
Yeah.
But my sister's telling, every time this happens, my sister will say, oh, she's going through a shy stage, she's shy. And now my niece has started saying that about her doll. Started saying, oh, she's shy, doll is shy. And so clearly she started telling herself a story about herself, which is being reinforced by other people. And then sort of, if you kind of take that into adult life, for example, I'm really scatty. I lose things all the time. But people, I think, are probably more forgiving of me being scatty because I'm a scatty one.
Yeah.
You kind of pay it back to yourself. I guess there's a saying, isn't there, about watch your thoughts because your thoughts become your words and your words become your actions. Your actions become your habits. Your habits become your character. Your character becomes your destiny.
And I think what you're saying is true. I thought it was good examples. You know, you're seen in a certain way, and as long as you're that shape, then people accept you, as it were. And then once you try and change your shape, as it were, I don't know what happens if you try to be less scatty. Maybe people feel a bit threatened by that, maybe. Or maybe the shy person, you know, it suits, as it were, other people for them to be shy, or whatever it is, or the, you know, the scapegoat of the family, etc. Bhante talks about we can really notice that if we go back after a number of years into a situation. For instance, it might be a family situation or old group of friends, school friends, university friends. And if you've changed and you go back, you can feel that people really want to squeeze you into a certain shape, don't you? And it's like they're seeing the past. They're seeing you as you were rather than as you are. And the purpose of the spiritual community, spiritual friendship, is to not hold people back, but to allow that growth and development to happen. To really see each other as we are more and more, and to allow that growth and development to happen, and not to sort of hold each other back as a group might.
It seems like something about imagination is important. Just if we could really see, I've been practicing for a number of years, and I've still not broken quite a number of my habits that are unhelpful. But I think if I could really, really see them as habits,
yes,
I'd be further along. I think it's what Svetlana was saying about somehow not. Or Bhante is saying that actually we're knots of energy. We've got ourselves into a knot. But actually that's not who we are.
No, no.
We're actually just... we're identifying with something that doesn't exist.
Yes, yes.
So if we could really see the habit as a habit,
yes,
I think we'd be well on the way to loosening that knot.
Even if
it's still got the same shape.
Yes. So we tend to see ourselves, this is me, and this is real, and plainly I'm not going to get beyond this, maybe a little bit I'll change, but seeing yourselves I'm just one big habit, I could just let that habit go, and then
or at least not feel it so much, or identify with it so much.
So having our identity maybe with something a lot bigger. A lot bigger than just who we think we are, but sort of holding it lightly, who we are lightly, but also identifying with something a lot bigger, you know, ultimately enlightenment, the Buddha, as it were. Hey, do you want to say?
It is interesting, now at this point, after learning what I've been learning about habits and stuff, seeing other people. You were saying about how you see yourself just how people would say I've got an addictive personality. I like smoking. Anything like people, they make excuses for themselves. But I don't think that how people would separate themselves from other people, it's easy for you, that's in your personality. And then I think that's funny how people do that. They kind of give themselves an allowance, or you give yourself an allowance to be lazy, but just I can't do it.
That's it. And it's good to look, at oneself, isn't it, and just see what those are for us. For instance, is it laziness? Is it whatever it is?
But it kind of plays you down when someone says it, doesn't it? When they say, I wish I was like you and had that ability, and you just think that puts less emphasis on how hard it is for me. Do you know what I mean?
Say a bit more about that.
My dad always says stuff like, whether it's when I gave up smoking, or even just learning to play an instrument, or anything like that. They're just you're gifted. To me, kind of says that I didn't work hard.
Okay.
It wasn't hard for me to do that. Somehow it comes easy to me, and not to you. It's just as hard for me to learn to do.
It's an interesting area that's really good, isn't it? Sort of noticing when people say that to us, and also noticing where we do it ourselves. Do we come along and think, "Oh, it's all right for him or her; they can meditate, and they're into Buddhism, etc." They can make progress. And I remember going. I was seeing a talk a while ago, and saying, "Well, the people that you really respect, That was hard won. That was hard won. And I thought, oh God, yeah, that's right. I think it was a similar point. I thought, oh well, it was all right for them because, you know, they obviously had ideal conditions, etc. But actually, it was hard won. It was an awful lot of effort to get where they are now. Okay, so we probably better begin to wrap up now. There's an awful lot more of the talk. We've only just covered the first of the fetters. But I can just really recommend, if at all that's whetted your appetite, go onto freebuddhistaudio.com and listen to it. It's called The Taste of Freedom, and it's always worth listening to Bhante, to his talks. And, there's a lot on there. So, thank you. And we're going to continue looking at Bhante's classics over the next few weeks. So, hope to see you next week.
Thank you. Okay.